From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Probably no other American political speech has been recited or remembered as much as Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. On this President's Day, we talk with Gary Wills about how Lincoln's speech changed the history of American political thought. Wills analyzes the speech in his book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. Wills is a political columnist and the author of critical studies of Presidents Kennedy, Nixon, and Reagan. Also today, our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, reads from his latest book of poems and talks with us about that side of his life. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording of ballads by trombonist J.J. Johnson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton takes the case for economic sacrifice to the American people tonight. The president will give his first broadcast address from the Oval Office 2 hours from now. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The president will formally unveil his new economic program in a Wednesday night speech before Congress, but tonight's address promises to be an attempt to explain to the American people why he will ask many of them to pay more in taxes or get by with less help from the government. At a White House photo opportunity this morning, Mr. Clinton gave a preview of his argument.
I'm going to offer a program that will create half a million or more jobs in the short run. That is highly progressive, that is very well balanced, that is faithful to the great middle class of this country and good for the things that we care about.
But Republicans are already attacking the details of the plan that have come to light. Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole said yesterday that Mr. Clinton's plan offers little that is bold or new and relies on more taxing and spending. I'm Andy Bowers at the White House.
The president's economic package is expected to include a broad-based energy tax that would be based on the heating content of various fuels. The president has said that the heat content approach would be more progressive than a tax based strictly on sales. Two clouds of smoke rose over downtown Bogota today when two 100-pound car bombs exploded. Four people were killed and more than 120 were injured. Leslie Werpsa reports from Bogota.
The car bombs blew up one after another around 10:30 a.m. in central zones of Bogota, causing extensive damage but leaving few victims. One of the bombs appears to have been directed at former Justice Minister Enrique Parejo. Parejo had just arrived at his downtown office when a bomb exploded nearby. One of his bodyguards was wounded. Parejo has unrelentlessly criticized Colombia's drug barons and the government's policy of striking plea bargaining deals with traffickers who turn themselves into the authorities. Parejo survived a previous attack on his life. Hitmen apparently working for drug traffickers shot him in January 1987 in Budapest, where he was serving as ambassador. 37 people have died in car bombings in Colombia since drug trafficker Pablo Escobar announced a month ago that he would resume violent attacks, abandoning his plans to surrender. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson said today that he would organize a hunger strike in the United States unless the Clinton administration allows HIV-infected Haitians to enter the country. After meeting today with White House Chief of Staff Mac McClarty, Jackson said he supports the president's Haitian policy but wants action within a week. Yesterday, the civil rights leader visited the Haitian refugee camp at the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba. The refugees there are eligible for asylum in the U.S. in other respects, but have been denied entry because they carry the virus associated with AIDS. This is NPR. The OPEC oil cartel has reportedly reached an agreement to boost oil prices by limiting production. Wire Service reports quoted OPEC delegates as saying that Kuwait has agreed to accept a lower production quota than it originally demanded. Kuwait has been pumping as much oil as it could while it rebuilt its oil production system after the Persian Gulf War. The Emirates' output finally reached a point that worried the other members of the oil cartel and prompted them to insist that Kuwait cut back. The Parliament of Slovakia has elected that country's first president. Slovakia became an independent state when Czechoslovakia split apart peacefully on January 1st. Burton Bolag reports.
Michal Kovac, who ran unopposed, was elected by a comfortable majority in the Slovak parliament. Mr. Kovac is a member of the ruling Movement for a Democratic Slovakia, the party of Slovakia's populist prime minister, Vladimir Mečiar. But Mr. Kovács won the support of the largest opposition party, the former communists, by promising, if elected, to remain above party politics. Mr. Kovács, a former banker, was thrown out of the Communist Party after the 1968 Soviet-led invasion of Czechoslovakia. He is seen as a cautious, middle-of-the-road politician. In a statement meant to reassure Slovakia's large Hungarian minority, the new president said the country must be a good homeland for all its citizens, regardless of their ethnic identity. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Prague.
A heavy storm is moving across the central part of the country, dumping snow and then freezing it in place with single-digit temperatures. About 18 inches of snow fell in parts of Arkansas, disrupting electrical service and closing schools. Schools were also closed in southwest and south-central Kansas, which got up to 7 inches of snow. Places in Nebraska and Oklahoma got as much as 6 inches of snow. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this President's Day, we're going to talk about one of the greatest speeches in American political history. Gary Wills describes Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as words that remade America. If Lincoln's speech has been reduced to a cliche in your mind, stick around and listen to Gary Wills read and interpret it. Our interview was recorded last summer after the publication of his book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. Wills is also the author of three critical studies of American presidents, Nixon Agonistis, The Kennedy Imprisonment, and Reagan's America. He's also written about the collision of religion and politics in America. The Gettysburg Address was delivered at the dedication of the Battlefield Cemetery where thousands of soldiers fell after one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg in 1863.
The battles ended on July 3rd, and on July 4th, people woke up, and this little village of 2,000-some people found 8,000 dead bodies in their fields and gardens and farms, and six or so dead bodies of horses and mules. So just covering them up at first was a tremendous problem. Then after they had done that, pretty much hugger-mugger wherever they lay, people started coming from Union states, families, delegations from the states, trying to reclaim the bodies and take them back for honorable burial. But nobody knew where their contingents were, where individuals were, so they were rummaging around, turning up bodies almost at random. This presented such a health hazard that the Pennsylvania authorities said, no, you can't take the bodies away. And they set up an interstate commission to finance and govern a new cemetery. But they couldn't start moving the bodies until the first frost came, which means that as they tried to identify them, they had been lying in the ground for 3 months at the outset and for 9 months by the time they finally finished up. It was very hard to identify bodies. They had to take the southerners away. They had to find out what state each northern body came from. They had to do ghastly things like try to sort out separated body parts according to the proper trunk. So it was a very grisly thing, and only 2,000 or less, about a third of the cemetery was filled when Lincoln came there. They hadn't been able to beat the freeze of the ground, and so they had to continue in the spring. So it was all very unfinished. There was no monument. Lincoln could not speak in the obvious place because people would have been treading on these fresh graves. So he had to speak higher up the hill. So it was a time for healing, and that's why the local representative, David Wills, had appointed Edward Everett, the great orator, to come and give his customary two-hour speech, which was very popular. He drew a tremendous crowd. If he had not been there, 15,000 people would not have heard Lincoln speak, because Lincoln didn't have that drawing power.
How do you think Lincoln saw his mission with the Gettysburg Address?
Well, he knew about these cemetery dedications. They were big cultural events in his time, and he had been to at least one that we know of in Springfield. Getting people out into nature was a transcendentalist cause in the mid-19th century. They wanted to get away from the churchyards and go out into nature where people would come and meditate on death. They loved these liminal experiences of crossing barriers between life and death, sleep and awake, etc. So these cemeteries were considered schools of learning. In fact, children were deputed to go and take care of them so that they could contemplate death from an early age. And he knew that. He had consulted the man who laid out the cemetery, William Sanders, who told him that he had carefully plotted it so that there was no hierarchical order, no precedence of officers over men or this state over that state. So lying in the ground, they enacted, as it were, the idea that all men are created equal. Lincoln had invited him to the executive mansion to discuss this, the rationale. It was part of his preparation. He had clearly prepared very carefully, not waiting to scribble on the train or wherever at the last minute.
You know, I'm sure I'm not alone in being one of the many students who had to memorize some or all of the Gettysburg Address. I can't remember how much I had to memorize. All I remember is 4 score and 7 years ago, which I kind of remembered as 4 score and 20 years ago. I mean, I didn't even get that right. And so it was really interesting for me to go through your book and to reread the address and realize, wow, it really is beautifully written. I never, ever noticed that. And all the times that I've had to read the address, to tell you the truth. And I never really thought of it as colloquial either. But you've put it in historical context in the book and show how this really was incredibly colloquial for its time, for oratory.
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it colloquial. It was brief, certainly. It was pregnant. It was not flowery. There are very few overt images. But the language is actually quite Latinate. You know, he says things like conceived in liberty, not born in freedom, dedicated to the proposition, not sworn to a truth, etc. And it's very abstract. He doesn't mention particulars. He never even mentions Gettysburg. He doesn't mention the North or the South or slavery or the Union. It's astonishing what he does not mention. He talks about this in an almost scientific way, that this is an experiment in freedom. We're finding out here whether this nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, anything in that category, can long endure. And if we prove that the experiment is survivable, then liberty shall not perish from the earth. So as opposed to Everett, who went into tremendous detail about the battle and excoriated the South for invading this peaceful valley and that kind of thing, Lincoln, as usual, talks above North and South of a great national mission that's being worked out in the war. And, of course, that's why he wanted to go there so badly. He was trying to redefine the mission of the nation in the midst of war so that they would come out of these horrendous scenes, these bloody battles, the beginning of modern warfare, really, with all of the technology of death, with a new birth, as he calls it, of freedom, that we went back to our origins and realized that we hadn't lived up to the proposition that all men are created equal. We'd had slavery, we'd had these other things. But now we have to continue the effort that the fathers dedicated us to when they brought this nation out of the continent in a kind of virgin birth at the beginning.
How does the language of the Gettysburg Address compare with the typical oratory of the time?
Well, as I say, it's less flowery. For one thing, it's brief. He realized that the attention span was getting shorter. He and Mark Twain came to this realization at about the same time.
Hey, and this was before television.
Absolutely.
Couldn't
but
blame
it was
that.
But it was the time of the telegraph, of steam, of the railroad. The pace of life had picked up. And of course, Lincoln was tremendously aware of that because he was at the center of the telegraphic communiques from all the battlefields with all of his generals. He used to go across to the War Office, right across from the Executive Mansion then, and spend hours sending and receiving telegrams. And he was very upset at officials and generals and engineers and others who would send him these verbose things where he's waiting for the message and they go on for sentence after sentence after sentence. He's not finding what he wants to hear. He liked Grant because Grant had tremendous economy of language, too. Grant proved to be a very good writer after the war. But he had this sense that life was picking up. So in the address, he rarely uses and or but or that kind of thing. He uses ascendaton, as the rhetoricians say. It's we cannot dedicate, we cannot hallow, we cannot consecrate these staccato phrases coming at you, government of the people, by the people, for the people. It's not government of the people and, or government of the people, by the people, and for the people. He drops all of those things. So there's a tremendous leanness and tautness to the address.
I think this would be a good time for me to ask you to read the Gettysburg Address. And I think a lot of our listeners will hear it differently than they've heard it before. And let me reintroduce you. My guest is Gary Wills, and his new book is about the Gettysburg Address. It's called Lincoln at Gettysburg, The Words That Remade America. And what do you say? You want to give it a go?
Okay. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation, so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
You describe the Gettysburg Address as having revolutionized the revolution, and as having changed the way people thought about the Constitution. How?
Well, it culminated a long campaign that he had undertaken in the late 1850s to get away from the problem posed by a Constitution that recognized slavery. He said we have to look back to the Declaration of Independence, which pledged us to the proposition that all men are created equal, and treat the Constitution as a first attempt at achieving that ideal, which still has to be worked on. The ideal remains, though the embodiment and various forms of government can and should change. This was an elaborate trap that he had laid for Stephen Douglas in his debates with him. He kept saying over and over in various ways, oh, you want to get rid of the Declaration of Independence? And he said, well, no, I don't really want to do that, because, of course, it was a sacred symbol by then. And he said, well, what do you make of that clause about all men being created equal? Or what do you make of the idea that we are one people? Because Jefferson began by saying, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the bonds which tie them to another people. He was going against the idea that the Constitution was merely a compact between sovereign states. So all of this is concentrated in the tremendous prominence he gives to the Declaration in the Gettysburg Address. You notice he begins 67 years ago, which takes us back to 1776. If he had wanted to take us back to 1789 in the Constitution, he would have had to say 66 years ago our country was brought forth. And when he ends up saying government of the people, that had become a fighting phrase for him, because the Southerners and their supporters in the North, and Stephen Douglas in particular, had said, we are not one people. We are a collection of different peoples, different states, each of them actually or potentially sovereign, who can resume their sovereignty at will. Now, Lincoln had some warrant for this in various legal doctrines, but it was not the preeminent view. He made it that in the course of his long campaign in this. His first inaugural address spells it out in great detail. But all of that is implicit in the Gettysburg Address. And because the address became so rapidly a touchstone of what the war was all about, he made people think of the country as dedicated to equality and as single in its peopleness, so that up until the time of the war, everybody always used the United States as a plural noun. The United States are a government by contract or whatever. From the time the war ended, everybody uniformly used it as a singular noun. The United States is a government of regular procedures.
We'll be back with Gary Wills after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Gary Wills, is the author of Lincoln at Gettysburg.
Let me tell you something I'm not sure of. It seems to me today people are almost consciously trying not to be subtle in their public oratory because they're afraid people won't get it. And I'm wondering if you think that the thousands of people who were assembled to hear Lincoln got all the kinds of subtleties that you're talking about now.
No, I don't think most of them got it at the first go.
Well, it wasn't played back on video afterwards.
Well, but it immediately went into print, and the text was read and available. But a lot of people would have got it. He certainly read it well. He was a great deliverer of speeches. We tend to forget that. He had a high tenor voice that carried very well outdoors, and he had wonderful timing. He was a great storyteller, so he always knew how to reach the punchline. He loved to read Shakespeare out loud, Shakespearean speeches, and other speeches for that matter. Reading speeches was his principal reading. He loved the word, and he loved the spoken word. So I think it would have been understood basically by people, but there's always more. I am still understanding it more and more as I read it. But you talk about current speeches, that kind of the ability to refer somewhat subtly, as you say, is a little hard in the modern world. Probably one of the last bastions of that is church oratory, because there is a common stock of biblical knowledge or phrases, so that I suppose the last great speech delivered in this country was Dr. King's at the March on Washington.
The I Have a Dream speech.
Yes. Which begins, by the way, 50 years ago. It picks right up from the Declaration, from the Gettysburg Address. He goes back to that.
Looking back over the past few presidents, is there anyone who you would call a great speechmaker? But I'm thinking, even if you did, you'd be talking about the way they delivered somebody else's lines, because virtually no politicians write their own speeches anymore.
That's true. On the other hand, we shouldn't assume that you cannot be a great president unless you write your own speeches. Franklin Roosevelt didn't write his own speeches.
You mean a great president or a great orator?
Well, even he was a fairly good orator, too. George Washington didn't write his own speeches. So you can have Ronald Reagan delivered the texts that were given to him well. He was a practiced orator. So I don't think the secret is that you have to write your own speeches. Roosevelt didn't write the first inaugural address, for instance, which certainly had an impact on the nation.
Oh, but I know when I was growing up and I found out that there were speechwriters, I felt really cheated. I thought, well, I was under the impression that these guys were speaking from their heart. And they'd sat down and they'd struggle through what they wanted to say and what words they wanted to use, and we were witnessing the results of that. And then I realized, no, that, you know, they've someone's on salary to do this kind of thing, and then they read it either, you know, the president or the candidate reads it either well or poorly, you know?
Yes, but I don't think that you should judge an oration simply in terms of that. You're arguing as if there's something inauthentic, that it's not their own words. That's the same kind of argument that makes people want Lincoln to have improvised or to have written at the last minute. They think that the more spontaneous it is, the more sincere it is, the more authentic, and that if it's worked at, if you've put in elbow grease and midnight oil and that kind of thing, that it's somehow not as authentic, it's phony, it's more distant. Lincoln certainly didn't think that. He wrote all of his speeches very slowly, and his law partner Herndon said that he did the same with his law briefs. He was a slow, careful composer. He was not spontaneous, and in fact, as president, he refused constantly to give speeches when he was called on the spur of the moment. He said, my words are too important. And we're talking about ghostwriting. Lincoln is interesting because he ghostwrote in reverse. He wrote some of the documents for his subordinates. He knew that getting the phrasing just right was so important as he tried to define the whole meaning of this struggle that he would write documents for the War Office to release.
I wonder if you think that in their own way speeches are becoming obsolete, especially now that candidates are talking more in an interview context. And with mass media functioning the way they do, you don't need to make a speech at a pulpit for a lot of people to be able to hear you, or at a platform.
Well, certainly the ease of communication through television has made it harder to give a formal speech. You know, it was a shock to many people when Roosevelt came into their homes with the so-called fireside addresses. Actually, they were quite stilted, too, if we go back and look at them. But people had not been used to having a president speak in their home. They had normally seen him in newsreels or at the theater or something of that sort. We certainly have got a more relaxed, more informal style for day-to-day use. On the other hand, people do want major speeches, and they feel disappointed when people don't come up to them. And when a good speech comes along, like that of Cuomo to the Democratic Convention, or Dr. King's, or some of Jesse Jackson's, they still work. People obviously find in them something that they don't find simply in a give-and-take talk show. So I don't... They'll never be obsolete, after all. There are big occasions in our life in which we want a big celebration or a statement of big ideals, whether it's funerals or weddings sometimes or the launching of new endeavors of whatever sort. For those things, we want a larger human statement, and we feel disappointed when it's not there.
Gary Wills is the author of Lincoln at Gettysburg. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Regular Fresh Air listeners know Lloyd Schwartz as our classical music critic. Lloyd is also a poet. His latest collection, Goodnight Gracie, takes its title from George Burns and Gracie Allen. Lloyd will read from his collection and talk with us about his writing. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording of ballads by trombonist J.J. Johnson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Haitian detainees entered their 17th day of fasting today on the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba. Their request for political asylum in the U.S. has gained added momentum, with civil rights leader Jesse Jackson announcing he's also taking part in the hunger strike. Melissa Mancini reports.
Reverend Jackson says he will fast with the Haitian refugees while pressuring President Bill Clinton to lift the ban on HIV-infected immigrants. All of the 267 Haitians being detained at the U.S. Naval Base have proved they qualify for political asylum, but have been refused entry to the United States because they have AIDS or are infected with the HIV virus. Jackson told strikers during a meeting yesterday he would urge Mr. Clinton to allow them to go to the U.S. for treatment. Last week, the White House announced it would repeal a controversial rule that bars people infected with the AIDS virus from entering the U.S., but gave no time frame. For more than 2 weeks, the 15 strikers have taken only water and vitamins. Now they say they will refuse that. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
In Bosnia, the last bakery operating in Sarajevo ran out of fuel with which to run its ovens today. Utilities in the besieged city were cut months ago. Only the main government facility and other key locations get some electric service, which is preserved by crews who have braved fire from Serbian attackers. Fierce shelling kept residents indoors today, and Sarajevo leaders refused for a fourth day to distribute UN food aid. They are protesting the UN's failure to get supplies to eastern Bosnia. Muslims in that region are cut off by Serbian militia lines. The two men convicted of murdering Brazilian environmental activist Chico Mendes escaped from prison today in Brazil's western Amazon. NPR's David Welna reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Cattle rancher Darli Alves da Silva and his son Darcy both broke out of the state penitentiary where they'd been serving 19-year sentences for murdering rubber tapper leader Chico Mendes 4 years ago. The two men had been in prison there ever since being convicted in a widely publicized trial 2 years ago. They allegedly killed Mendes because of his efforts to create so-called extractive reserves in the rainforest, where cattle ranchers would be forbidden from cutting down the trees the tappers depended on for their livelihood. Seven other inmates also escaped in today's jailbreak. Local authorities say they have no idea where the men may have gone, nor whether they're armed. Several other rubber tappers in the area have received death threats since Chico Mendes' killers were imprisoned. I'm David Welna in Rio de Janeiro.
The top official of organized labor says unions will be generally supportive of the economic plan President Clinton is unveiling tonight. Lane Kirkland, president of the AFL-CIO, says unions like what they've heard so far, but there might be objections to certain tax increases. This is NPR News. Mike Tyson's lawyer asked an appeals panel today to give the boxer a new trial. In Tyson's first trial a year ago, he was convicted of rape, but his current lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, told the Indiana Court of Appeals today that the trial judge made several mistakes, so the conviction should be thrown out. Dershowitz said the judge should have allowed jurors to hear a tape recording of the phone call in which Desiree Washington reported that she had been raped. He also said the judge should not have barred three witnesses. The defense claims can contradict part of Washington's testimony. There's no indication of when the appeals court will rule. A senior United Nations official in Somalia says the deployment of UN troops there is likely to be extended to all areas of the country. The United Nations Security Council is due to decide on the move in the next 2 weeks. Lucy Hannon filed this report for the BBC.
The deployment of United Nations troops throughout Somalia is proposed in a report by UN Secretary General Dr. Boutros Ghali. The report, which drafts the second phase of the operation in Somalia, has been submitted to the UN Security Council and awaits approval. According to the UN, plans for the north were temporarily frozen when the Security Council approved United States military intervention 2 months ago. A senior UN official told me today there was never any doubt that troops would be extended to the north, but the proposal will come as a surprise to many. Only yesterday, U.S. Special Representative Robert Oakley criticized the UN, saying it had failed in its responsibilities to the Northern Territories.
Lucy Hannon reporting from Mogadishu. This is the fourth anniversary of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, and government forces marked the occasion by looting homes and shops in Kabul. The capital city has been devastated by fighting between the Islamic government troops and forces of a rival group. They all used to work together against the communists. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Regular listeners to Fresh Air know Lloyd Schwartz as our classical music critic. Lloyd is also a poet. His work has been published in several literary magazines, also The New Republic and the anthology The Best American Poetry, 1991. He also teaches in the creative writing department at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Last spring, we invited Lloyd to read from his latest book of poems and to talk with us about his writing. The book is called Goodnight, Gracie. That's the line that George Burns and Gracie Allen used to sign off with. Lloyd is going to read an excerpt of his poem, House Hunting, which he wrote after buying his house.
The experience of looking for a house was a lot more intense and complicated than I expected it to be. And there was a way that the people whose houses I was looking at were letting me into their lives, or really insisting that I get into their lives, that I know about their lives, more than the people who, you know, who were renting an apartment, say. And the poem is about three experiences that I actually had, and each section of the poem begins with the actual ad in the newspaper about that particular house. And this, I'm going to read the third section, the last section of the poem. So it begins with the newspaper ad for the house in question. Somerville. Solid two-family in superior location. Cedar-shingled beauty with spacious apartments and contemporary updating. Big sun deck and two-car garage. They're not speaking to me upstairs. My stepdaughter. We haven't spoken since the doll died last year. They even forgot my birthday. 73 today. Would you believe it? Cheers. Go on. Look around. I've got nothing to hide. It's oddly tasteful for this florid, garrulous grandpa. Low-slung, plastic-covered, blonde 50s sectionals. A couple of yellow brick planters. Built to myself. Not bad for an old man, eh? Fine-grained walnut paneling and sliding glass door cabinet suspended over the long oak kitchen counters. The master bedroom, once evidently two. I knocked down that wall with my own two hands. Looks unslept in. In the spare, rumpled den, an unmade daybed. A closet full of shirts. A few tiles missing in the shower. To tell you the truth, I lost interest when the doll died. That's why I'm selling. I used to fix up every little thing. Now I don't care. I could call my son and move in with him tonight. He keeps asking. Don't you believe me? Look, I'm picking up the phone. 25 years, and he's selling the house right out from under us. All my friends live on this street, my kids' friends. My husband had a restaurant around the corner, 3 blocks from here. It burned down 2 years ago. We still haven't collected the insurance. Now he's driving a cab. We'd buy the house ourselves if we had any money. Who thinks they'll ever have to move? There's so much stuff. We've still got all the kids' toys. At least we won't have to pay these heating bills. Winters, it's freezing in here. This year we were going to close off the living room on account of the cold. I feel sorry for anyone moving here. It's all his son's idea. If he died, my sister and me would get half the house. But if he sells it, he could leave all the money to his son. What can you do? You have to make the best. He drinks, did you notice? A certified alky. Even before my mother died. Believe me, he was never the greatest husband in the world. We get so worried about him, alone down there. He's fallen a dozen times, and he won't let us in, thinks we're spying on him. He just can't be trusted, changes his mind every 5 seconds. You know, at the last minute, he could decide not to sell. I'll be glad to see him taken care of, though. I just hope that son of his knows what kind of a bargain he's getting. Listen, is there any chance you could let us stay? We've been good tenants, fix things ourselves, always pay the rent on time. Of course, it would depend on how much you were planning to raise it. We could even squeeze in downstairs if you needed our place. Put in a daybed until my son leaves home. Make do. We've done it before. At least we could stay in our own neighborhood, our own house. It would be awful to have to move. Awful to move away.
That's Lloyd Schwartz reading from his new collection, Goodnight, Gracie. And, Lloyd, one of the things I really like about that poem is the sense of how you're looking for a house, but what you're getting initially is other people's lives and responsibility for them, responsibility you don't want.
That's right.
Did you buy this house?
I didn't. I bought, the poem is about the next to the last house I looked at, which was in Somerville, Mass., and I did end up buying a house very similar to it in also in Somerville.
Were there people who you had to ask to move out?
No, there weren't. It was a two-family house, and the tenants were built in, and I didn't have to ask them to leave.
That's nice. Do you not like the form of confessional poetry, or is it more that you just don't want to get that personal in your own poems?
Well, that's a very good question. And no, I don't have a problem about getting personal in my own poems. And before I started writing the dramatic monologues, I was writing only about myself. And I got to think that was very boring. Why would anyone be interested in me personally? And that I could find issues in the lives of people that I knew or made up that were richer or more serious in some ways than that I could be more objective about than the same issues in my own life.
One of your poems that is autobiographical is called In the Jewish Cemetery in Queens. And it's about visiting your father's grave shortly after he died in a cemetery where many people from your extended family are buried. And a stone's throw from your uncle's grave are the gravestones of many of the people from the Yiddish Theatrical Alliance, including such luminaries as Menashe Skolnick. And you say, my family rubbing elbows with celebrities. Would you describe the sensation of discovering these graves from the Yiddish theater near the graves of your own family?
Yeah. Well, I knew that the Yiddish theater graves were there because I had visited that part of the cemetery even when I was a child. But when my father died, I was old enough to, I mean, which wasn't so long ago, I was old enough to know who a lot of those figures were, and some of the graves look like billboards with the names are printed in diagonals as if they were on a billboard in front of the Yiddish theater, and I found something really deeply poignant, really heartbreaking about that, and I kept thinking, you know, all the world's a stage, and here even in a cemetery. The headliners are being, you know, or the actors are being presented as headliners on this other kind of stage. And as a, you know, as a frustrated actor myself, there was obviously it struck a very deep chord. And then coming at the time of my father's death, I think I was very vulnerable to feeling these things. It was a very moving experience.
We'll talk more with Lloyd Schwartz after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lloyd Schwartz. He's Fresh Air's classical music critic and author of the collection of poems, Goodnight, Gracie. When you started to listen to classical music when you were mm-hmm. young, did you find that you ever felt out of step because a lot of your friends listened to pop and rock and roll?
That was a kind of secret. I mean, I also listened to pop music and rock and roll, and I loved it, and I still do. I think my friends... Even my close friends probably weren't aware of how passionate I was about classical music. And then there were periods, I think in high school, for example, where I really stopped listening to classical music because I already felt out of step enough with my classmates. Back in college, I was really able to start listening very seriously to classical music again and could actually talk about it because I met friends and teachers who were also serious about it. So it was okay then. It's a great relief.
Did you ever play an instrument or sing?
Well, when I was 5 years old, I studied the violin for a year.
Five?
And when I was five.
Was it one of these Suzuki things or something? One of these Suzuki things for...
Oh, no, it wasn't. I mean, this was the mid-1940s, so it was nothing that advanced. It was, I went to the... I had a teacher at the Wurlitzer building in Manhattan, and we lived in Brooklyn, and my mother would take me on the subway. I had this little baby violin. I still have it. It's still in the basement at home. And I had a very serious European teacher named Mr. Blackman. And I didn't exactly love it, but I thought even as a young child, it was something that that I did care about, that I took seriously. And after a year. My father had an accident. He fell in the snow on his way home from work. He slipped in the snow and broke his leg, and he was out of work for, I think it was something like 9 months. And we couldn't afford, we were lucky we had enough saved up to buy food. And we really couldn't afford music lessons. There weren't, free music lessons in the school. And I think by the time the family could afford to support my music lessons again, I was old enough not to want to start from scratch all over again. And I was already in love with listening to music.
What kind of connections do you see, if any, between your approach to writing music criticism and your poetic style?
I think about that a lot. And I'm not sure what the answers are. I think as a critic, I want to be very direct. I want to speak to a reader. And in fact, being on Fresh Air taught me a lot about speaking to an audience.
Oh, because you're literally speaking.
Because you're literally speaking. And it's so much like what I want to do on the page. And I want poems to speak also, the musicians that I admire most, not only singers, but including singers and violinists and pianists and string quartets, are the ones who seem to speak to me, who speak to their audience, who have a kind of speaking voice along with the singing voice. I hate singers who are just doing vocal exercises or pianists who are just playing difficult passages of music. I want music to mean something, and it's all connected. I can't quite sort it out, but I know that what I love about poetry is very connected to what I love about music. And if I can write about music and write poems that speak, then I'm really fulfilling something that I deeply want to do.
Lord, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about a different side of your work, your poems. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you as always.
Lord Schwartz's latest book of poems, Good Night, Gracie, is published by the University of Chicago Press. Lord is Fresh Air's classical music critic. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton will address the nation tonight on the economy. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, will you be previewing the address on All Things Considered?
You bet. Andy Bowers will explain what's likely to be in President Clinton's talk tonight. He'll be focusing on the creation of jobs and cutting back on the federal deficit, of course. Also, we'll check in again with some of the families we talked with about the economy back during the presidential campaign. I'll take some time to go back over the past 13 years in Yugoslavia, starting with the funeral of Josip Broz Tito, the communist leader who was holding Yugoslavia together. Also, stories and songs about wandering around America for more than a quarter century, as we'll talk with bluesman Paul Jeremiah.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the 1940s, J.J. Johnson was the first trombonist to meet the technical demands of bebop, and because of that, he became the primary influence on his instrument for decades to come. In 1970, Johnson retired from jazz to work in Hollywood studios, where he wrote music for a few movies and for TV shows like Harry D., The $6 Million Man, and Mayberry RFD. In 1988, Johnson returned to playing jazz. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Johnson's latest album is low-key, but it's a winner.
Jazz fans usually think of the original beboppers as speed demons who prided themselves on playing very complex music very fast. But those musicians also had an abiding love of slow ballads. If the quick tunes tested their technical resources, the slow ones revealed their soul. So it shouldn't be much of a surprise that J.J. Johnson's new album is devoted to ballads with a couple of blues thrown in for variety. But even the trombonist fans may be surprised by how emotionally affecting the music is. J.J. Johnson's new album for the Concord Jazz label is called Vivian, after his late wife, who died a couple of years ago. The titles of some of the standards he plays hint at how deeply he feels that loss. There Will Never Be Another You, But Not For Me, Cole Porter's I Love You. Earlier in life, there could be something jocular or showy about Johnson's ballads, as if he were a little giddy with his own technique. He's purged those tendencies from his playing here. It's not that he's never playful or never reminds you of his amazing chops, but that he sounds more fundamentally serious. This is from Irving Berlin's How Deep Is the Ocean? Most great jazz musicians periodically confront the issue of tone quality. Even players who've attained a gorgeous sound may not stay satisfied with it, but let it evolve in another direction. It's one thing musicians do to stay interested in their own playing. Johnson has always had an attractive and substantial trombone sound, but has taken on more of a dark, rich timbre as he's grown older, the way a patina builds up on a piece of copper as it ages. Rhythm players here are guitarist Ted Dunbar and a trio who often work together, pianist Rob Schneiderman, bassist Rufus Reed, and drummer Akira Tana. But J.J. Johnson dominates this record as a soloist, which is as it should be. I confess my interest drops off whenever the spotlight falls on anyone else. Given how much of a fuss that fans, writers, and musicians made about J.J. Johnson's return to active duty in 1988, it's puzzling that Vivian is only the third record he's made since then. To these ears, it's the best of the bunch.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator in New York. He reviewed J.J. Johnson's new album, Vivian. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two generations of a gang family. Luis Rodriguez is a poet and publisher who's just written a memoir about his gang days in Los Angeles in the 60s. He wrote the book with the hope it would encourage his 17-year-old son to leave his gang. We'll talk with Luis Rodriguez and his son Ramiro. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.